stop loving me yet.
Hi, I'm Lil.
And I'm Fitz, and you're listening to Not Once VS.
Here in the UK, we're having rather more summer than we know what to do with at the moment. In fact, my intrepid mum informs me that we haven't had quite this much summer since 1976. But we're trying to make the most of the sunshine, and we've been chugging around the countryside in the coffee mobile in earnest, hunting down all the spookiest places to share with you, our lovely listeners. So Fitz, what have we got coming up on today's episode?
We have a very interesting EVP from the Ghost Detective. A listener sends us a paranormal postcard, plus more fantastic paranormal stories. And as the anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth approaches, we track down some ghosts from the Wars of the Roses.
But before we get started on all of that, we want to give a massive shout out to our brand new patrons.
Jamie Wagner,
Donna Heron,
Christina Hanna,
Julie Fuller,
Abby,
Sean Thomason,
Eileen Darra,
and Liz Evans. And as always, we want to thank all of our patrons, old and new, for helping to keep the show on the air.
And also for helping us buy some much-needed new equipment. We've recently invested in some fantastic new microphones that should help cut down on the editing time, and hopefully also improve the quality of the show.
So onto the paranormal radar, and today we have something a little bit different for you. If you listened last episode, you'll remember that we spoke to Adrian Perkins, author of the series of Ghost Detective books, and very excitingly, Adrian has kindly sent us an EVP that he recorded during his investigations at the Twin Woods Aviation Museum, and he's kindly allowed us to share it with you.
The recording was made on an old tape dictaphone and was in part of the museum that at the time was a derelict building.
When they played the recording back, they were rather surprised to discover some very loud noises, as well as a sing-song voice faintly in the background. Bear in mind that the recording quality isn't the best, it is on a dictaphone, but the sound you hear will be very obvious.
There's also a couple of points in the tape where Adrian and his colleague pop back in to check the tape. This is an amalgamation of several recordings, so there's a few points where you'll hear them talking. In one of those points at about the middle, there's also a sing-songy voice that isn't them. See if you can hear it.
So Fitz, what do you make of that? I mean, those noises, they're really loud. There's some huge bangs and crashes in there that kind of reminded me of our haunted house.
Yeah, I got that impression as well. I know Adrian was under the impression that there was gunfire.
And you can see where that thought comes from with the World War II connotations.
Definitely, I can understand it, and it does seem to have some of the characteristics of gunfire. It feels really...
poltergeisty?
It feels something... I feel like I know the noise, but I can't quite place it.
I got that feeling as well. And the only thing I could think was that the biggest crashes really remind me of the experiences we had in our very haunted house, where it sounded like people were throwing boxes around upstairs. And I don't know whether that's where that feeling of familiarity comes from.
Very possibly. It's a shame that it was such a poor recording, because when I looked at it, that most of the bottom end and the top end wasn't there.
So you couldn't repair it too much?
No, there wasn't much there to work on, so it's really difficult to say. But yeah, interesting. What really stood out to me, though, was it sounded like something was tapping the microphone.
I got that as well. I think I heard it three times, just exactly like it sounds when somebody just tap, tap. And it was twice. It was two taps all three times.
Yeah.
Tap, tap. And you can hear how close to the microphone that was.
Yeah. And bearing in mind that Adrian and his colleague were literally just outside.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of this going on, they didn't hear a thing.
No. And we spoke last episode about how isolated this museum is. It is in the middle of fields. There's really nothing around. You don't get sounds from the road, traffic sounds, that kind of thing.
No,
there's just nothing nearby.
It's literally miles away from the road. The closest thing is the farmhouse. And that's a good, I don't know, 15-minute walk from where we were at the museum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and like I say, they were outside. They'd have seen anyone that was in the building. They'd have seen anyone coming up to the building.
They'd have most certainly heard this ruckus going on.
They were close enough to have definitely heard that. So strange.
It's very strange, but the voice.
The voice. Yeah, you'll hear Adrian and his colleague sort of when they come back in to check the tape. I think there's one point they say check, check or something like that. But the sort of sing-songy voice, it wasn't either of them.
No, and I think having heard it isolated, you can tell that it's not either of their voices. So Fitz has very cleverly cleaned it up a bit for us.
Yes, I've taken out as much of the background noise as possible and I've boosted the level a bit so it's a lot easier to hear, and I've looped it three times because it's quite short. We wanted to play the clip for you before we tell you what we think it says, as we're both interested to see what you think it might be. So do comment on our Facebook and Twitter and let us know what you think. Now, I think it sounds like I called out or I called south, but I sent Adrian a copy of the cleaned recording and he thinks it sounds like my cool place. We were both surprised that we heard such different things and we're keen to find out what you think.
I can definitely hear the call, but to be honest, my first impression was I called out. I can't quite fix that last word. It's more like mouth or something a little bit softer, but the beginning bit, I called, was quite obvious to me.
Yeah, and I initially thought it was I called Ralph. It sounded a bit to me.
Yeah, but it could be that slightly softer word, but I just find it so fascinating what the differences are between what people hear. So please, please do get in touch and let us know what you hear. If you want to hear more from Adrian's investigations, he has the full recordings from Twin Woods and other locations available for sale on CD through his website.
We'll put a link to his website in the show notes description on our website. And don't forget, you can also find his Ghost Detective series of books for sale there as well.
And we'd just like to say a big thank you to Adrian for allowing us to use his EVP on the show. We were so excited to be able to share that with you guys.
And so on to the stories. And this one is a paranormal postcard from listener Red about her holiday in Dorset.
My family and I recently spent our holidays in a small village in Dorset. We were staying in the old mill, which is situated in the oldest part of the village. In fact, the landlord informed us that the remains of a Roman road run right past the house. Although most of the building standing today dates from the early part of the 19th century, there was a mill listed on this site in the Domesday Book of 1086, so the name, Old Mill, is no exaggeration. It was a very pretty place. You could see the original exposed beams and the rather rickety-looking platform that spanned right across the fast-flowing river, which would have originally powered the mill wheel. Rather alarmingly, on our second night there was a flood warning, and we were told to move all our belongings upstairs. Fortunately, we managed to enjoy our holiday without the river bursting its banks. It was a bit hodgepodge, with lots of wonky staircases, pillars in odd places, and ledges that we were constantly tripping over. A legacy, I suppose, from all the mill machinery that once filled the building. It was quaint, if rather impractical, but there was a certain edge to it, a rather creepy feeling. As soon as I was in my bedroom, I felt like someone was there, or that someone was watching me, regardless of whether I was alone or had company. In one corner of my room was a small, narrow staircase which went up to the attic. There was no door, only a curtain, so essentially my room was open to the attic. Throughout the night, I heard creaks like the creaking of floorboards, but I brushed it off as the settling noises of an old house. However, it turned out that other members of the family had been hearing noises too. Footsteps overhead, as though someone were walking around in the empty attic. The attic, which was only separated from my room by a curtain. The attic itself ran the whole length of the house, but was separated into three by false walls. One was made to look like a bookcase, but had a secret door through to the next section. The middle section was windowless, and the darkness didn't help the creepy feeling the place gave me. We walked through the attic on the first day to explore, but it didn't feel welcoming, and nobody bothered going up there again. But on the last day before we had to go home, I popped up for a last look. I wish I hadn't, because when I reached the middle section with the secret door, it was locked. Now, nobody had been up there since we'd done our first walkthrough, and of course, I knew that we hadn't locked the door then. So how had it locked itself? Now I knew that something was walking around in this attic at night, locking doors as it pleased, and I still had one night to sleep in a room that wasn't even separated by a door. When we asked the landlord if the place was haunted, he replied, "Very." Apparently, the ghost of a woman has been seen walking from the bathroom, across the landing, and then disappearing. I recall at that end of the landing, there was a step down to a lower level, as if it may have originally been a different part of the building. Maybe that's why she vanished at this point. He also told us that at one time, part of the mill was divided into cottages, and that 12 children lived there. The second ghost said to haunt the mill is that of a little girl, one of these 12 children, and apparently she's heard walking around in the attic. It was an interesting experience, but needless to say, I don't think we'll be going back, ever.
I think we might have to pay it a visit, though.
I think we might. I think that's going on our list. Thank you so much, Red. I love getting your paranormal postcards. Please, please, if you're going on holiday somewhere and you have a spooky encounter, or even if you just come across somewhere with a really amazing legend, please email it to us. Let us know.
You can get in touch through our website or simply email us at contact@knockonceforyes.com.
Well, I think the thing that got me most about that story was to hear the walking around in the attic and know that there's only a curtain separating you and there's not even a door to shut out the ghost.
No, I think having something that you could potentially barricade would be something
of a
slightly
comfort.
More reassuring, yes.
I mean, it doesn't sound very intuitive, really. I'm sure a door couldn't actually stop a ghost, but it would make you feel better.
Yeah, it's like the duvet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Throw a duvet over your head, you'll be fine.
Perfectly safe.
It was also quite interesting that she'd had her experience before asking the landlord about whether it was haunted or not, and then he corroborated her experiences as well.
And the other thing that's just occurred to me is the fact that this building is over running water.
Oh, yeah.
Which is something we hear of a lot. I mean, to be fair, it's obviously such an old place that I'd be surprised if it wasn't haunted anyway. But I do wonder if having that running water underneath contributes to how haunted it is.
Interesting. We're going to have to go and investigate at some point if we can.
I think we need to take a holiday. Well, thank you so much to Red for sharing her paranormal postcard with us. And we're not quite done with the stories yet. This next one is from Ian.
I've always loved ghost stories, but never really believed in them. That is, until after my father died. After my father passed away, I went to stay with my mum. I ended up sleeping in my parents' room, as my mum didn't feel comfortable sleeping there. On my first night, I was awoken at about 2 a.m. by the sound of the bedroom door being pushed repeatedly. The door remained closed, but it was as if someone was having trouble opening it. Assuming it was mum, I asked if everything was okay, but there was no reply. And by the time I opened the door, she was gone. Not only that, but she was sound asleep in my old room. This all in the space of 2 or 3 minutes. The second night, the same thing happened. Again, at about 2 in the morning. But this time, I was a bit freaked out, and I stood at the door for a while, trying to summon the courage to open it. I could feel the door and handle moving. It was like someone trying to open a locked door. I yanked the door open and found the landing empty. I was now very freaked out, and not helped by the fact that the landing light had recently stopped working. It still doesn't to this day, despite attempts to repair it. Anyway, this went on night after night for a few weeks, although I never did open the door again at night. I must add at this point that my father used to work very odd hours and would often arrive home at about 1 or 2 in the morning. I don't know if I read or simply heard somewhere that you should talk to a ghost and encourage them to move on. So one day, when I was alone in the house, not a cat in hell's chance I was going to do it at night, I had a talk with my father. We never really did get along, so I was pretty blunt about what he should do. I felt really stupid, sat at the top of the stairs talking to myself and hoping that the neighbours couldn't hear me. But that door never rattled again. All this happened some years ago, and I never told my mum about it, obviously not wanting to upset her. However, shortly before she died, she admitted that she had in the past seen a woman with red hair standing at the bottom of her bed, smiling at her. She said the woman was not scary at all, but seemed kindly. This made me think of a time a few months before my father died. He was ill and in bed, and kept talking about the red lady. I thought he was hallucinating, but now I'm not so sure.
And thank you so much to Ian for sharing your story with us. I thought it was really interesting how Ian's clearly made a connection with the fact that his father used to finish work in the early hours of the morning, and the fact that these incidents were happening in the early hours of the morning, night after night, which led me to wonder, was this some kind of, maybe not a residual haunting, but a case of somebody continuing to go about their daily routine after they've died? But then there's that curveball at the end about a red lady.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You've got to wonder, and I'm presuming that they were seeing the same thing.
I would say so.
It's by no means guaranteed, obviously, but it does seem that they were both seeing someone. I'd be interested to know if they had a sort of a family member, although obviously being a married pair, you wouldn't expect them to share a relative either.
Or was it just somebody with a link to the house?
Possibly.
That's staying on, not quite an ancestral spirit, but maybe a kind of a protective spirit that, well, came with the house, I suppose.
I'm quite interested by the fact that talking to it seemed to solve the problem. And it makes me wonder whether there was some kind of confusion that, you know, he didn't know he was dead. And...
Well, it would fit in with the continuing with his daily routine, wouldn't it? Although I have heard in quite a few cases, actually, where people just really take charge and take back their house and say, now, look, this is my space. I want you to stop. You're making me uncomfortable. And a lot of times that does really work.
Yeah, and is it that a lot of these things are just...
confused.
Yeah, they don't know that they're dead.
Could be. Interesting.
Well, thank you again to Ian for sending in that story. We really enjoyed it. If you've got a paranormal story, please do get in touch and share it with us at notquantsvs.com. And whilst you're there, why not pay a quick visit to our merch store, grab yourself a Not Once VS t-shirt or hoodie. And don't forget to send us a picture of you in your new coffee garb. And if you like, we might even share it on our social media.
Hashtag shameless plug.
We're going to be telling you about some of the ghosts from the Wars of the Roses shortly. But first, another listener's story from Julie.
I've always had an interest in the paranormal. In fact, I had a couple of my own experiences when I was younger. Apparently, one of my first words was ghost, which I pronounced dost, while visiting my Nana. She lived in an old seminary, which was reputedly haunted, and probably wasn't helped by the fact that my Nana had dabbled with Ouija boards during regularly held meetings in which her and her friends would contact the dead. My dad later told me stories of bedclothes being pulled off their beds whilst they were laying in them, and faces appearing out of the darkness. My earliest memory of a paranormal experience occurred one Sunday morning whilst I was looking out of my bedroom window. I could clearly see what I'd decided at the time was a man going to heaven. The man was in the fetal position, but was head first up, knees held tightly to chest, and he was just floating peacefully up towards the sky, eventually disappearing. I was around the age of 7 at the time, but still remember it so vividly almost 40 years on. Years later, I married and had children of my own, my first child being Jordan. Many things happened when Jordan was a lot younger, but these four stories have always stuck in my mind. When Jordan was approximately 18 months old, he refused to sleep on his own, which isn't really that unusual, but we ended up in a monotonous routine where he would fall asleep in between me and my husband in our bed, and then we'd somehow manage to lift him into his own bed in order to get at least a few hours of decent sleep before he woke, realised his surroundings, and I'd end up sleeping the rest of the evening squashed up close to him on his toddler bed, exhausted, I may add. This particular evening, he wasn't very tired, but we were, and were struggling to settle him down for the night. He decided that a good game would be to climb over his dad, run round the bed to me, climb over me, then over his dad, run round the bed again, and so forth and so forth. We told him to stop, but he carried on, and we figured that he'd soon wear himself out and settle down. After about the 5th or 6th time of doing it, he suddenly stopped and froze. He was staring at a corner of the room near to where I was laying, and he had a look of sheer terror on his face. I immediately looked up to where he was staring, but I couldn't see anything. I grabbed him and placed him on the bed, but by then he'd started to scream and cry. He was terrified of something, and it was only then that I noticed our dog was barking madly at the corner too. My husband took the dog downstairs and left me to calm Jordan down. He did settle down eventually, but it took a good half an hour. At one point, he'd gotten himself into such a state that he began hyperventilating, which had never happened before. The dog took a lot of coaxing to get into the bedroom after that night. In fact, he slept downstairs for weeks after that incident. I often wonder what it was that Jordan saw that terrified him so badly. My husband, a stubborn non-believer, couldn't explain the events of that night, but agreed that something wasn't right. Jordan had always been frightened of going upstairs. Sometimes he'd kick and scream and we'd have to carry him upstairs, where he'd point to the top of the stairs saying, "People," as though someone was standing there. As there wasn't anything negative happening in the house, my mum and I came to the conclusion that maybe it was her mum, my Nana, that had passed away and that she was looking over him. My work colleagues and I decided to go on a psychic evening one night, which was being held in a village 10 miles away. I've always been very sceptical about the work of mediums and had made a conscious decision on the way there that if I was picked out, I would not feed them any information. We entered the village hall and there were many people there, all sat on chairs facing the front, hoping for a message to come through. The medium came out and introduced herself and explained her gift to us. Almost immediately, she received a message from a loved one for one of the audience. Still sceptical, I sat and listened, half of me nervous about getting a message, the other half knowing I'd be disappointed if I didn't. Then, I was picked out. I was beckoned over to the front of the hall, and the first thing the medium said to me was, "You have a little boy at home. He sees a lady at the top of your stairs." I was gobsmacked. She then went on to tell me that he was in no danger and the lady's name was Violet. She said a few more things about past family members. My father-in-law apparently came through, but I didn't recognise him from her description at the time, as I'd never actually met him. He'd passed away before I met my husband. To be honest, I wasn't paying that much attention. I was too busy racking my brains as to who the hell was Violet. The first thing I did when I got home was ring my mum. She was as shocked as I was, but couldn't recall anyone of that name in the family. So I rang my sister-in-law, as obviously it was somebody from my husband's side. But no, no Violets in his family either. This remained a mystery until a couple of years later, when I was in the attic having a clear out and I came across our mortgage papers. I started to read through them, mostly legal jargon from solicitors and the like, but then I turned a page and there it was, clear as day, the name Violet. A shiver went down my spine and the hairs on my arms stood on end. Oh my God. Being in the attic at such a spooky time wasn't very appealing, so I took the papers downstairs and began to read. It turns out that the couple we bought the house from actually bought the house from a Len and Violet. That was it, obviously. Although I knew Violet didn't die in the house, she had presumably passed away since and maybe come back to visit on occasion. Ever since Jordan was a few weeks old, my mum and I would take him with us and stay with an aunt, who has sadly since passed away. We loved our little holidays at Auntie Sandra's. She lived at the seaside town of Eastbourne, and we'd always spend our evenings walking along the seafront. The walk would take us past the Redoubt Fortress, which is an old circular coastal defence fort. It was built in 1805 as part of the British anti-invasion preparations during the Napoleonic Wars, and now has a visitor centre and is an exhibition venue. Just a few metres away from the fortress was a wall, only about 2 feet high and about 20 child steps long. Every night, Jordan would make one of us take his hand and lift him onto the wall, where he'd walk along right to the end and then jump off. This particular evening, he took his Nana's hand and she lifted him onto the wall. It was almost as if something had caught his eye. He turned towards the fortress and stopped in his tracks. He looked very frightened and we all turned to see what he was looking at, but we could see nothing out of the ordinary. He suddenly pulled my mum away from the wall as if he was protecting her from something. "What's the matter?" Mum asked. "Bad oo-oo," he replied. Jordan's vocabulary wasn't that extensive at that age, as he'd not long been learning to talk. But I knew that an oo-oo to Jordan was a monkey. We were very puzzled. Why would he have seen a bad monkey? The incident was forgotten about after the holiday, but a few weeks later we were watching a TV show and a cartoon skull appeared on the screen. "Oo-oo," he shouted, pointing at the screen. It suddenly dawned on me that what he'd actually seen in Eastbourne could have been a skull, or maybe a skeleton. Another incident involving Jordan occurred on Christmas, Boxing Day to be precise. We have a very close relationship with our neighbours. In fact, I had met the family years before, and they were the reason I purchased the house. I met Gail at work. Her and her husband Chris had two teenage daughters, Sarah and Joanne, and we became good friends. I even stayed with them for a while at one point whilst between jobs. Sadly, Chris passed away suddenly, and just over a year later, I bought the house next door. They came round for tea on Boxing Day evening, and we then watched a film, The Polar Express. Jordan seemed a little restless during the film, and when it finished, he stood up and looked very puzzled. We asked him what was wrong, to which he turned to the two girls and said, "Why was your dad sat watching the film with us?" We all stopped in our tracks. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Joe and Sarah's dad was there, Mum," pointing at an empty chair. "He was sat there watching the film with us." Gail left immediately. The paranormal scares her to death, and she was well aware of Jordan's psychic abilities, as she'd heard us talk about previous things that he'd said, and she would always instantly shut those sorts of conversations down. The two girls were a little spooked as well, and were both flummoxed as we'd never spoken to Jordan about their father. Jordan is now almost 16, and although we believe he was very sensitive to spirits when a lot younger, like myself, he has since lost that ability, and he cannot remember any of these incidences which occurred when he was between the ages of 1 and 3 years old.
And thank you to Julie for sharing those stories with us. There's so many things that I find fascinating about most of these stories. The first one being that it seems like both Julie and Jordan were both sort of sensitive to these things at a younger age and then steadily grew out of it. That does seem to be something that's commonly reported.
Mm.
The other thing was, and I'll give you a little bit of background. I suffered from night terrors as a child. According to my mother, I don't remember them. But I've also found that a lot of people that have these experiences when they're younger also used to suffer from night terrors.
Well, that's interesting. So there's a link there. I think my brother used to suffer from night terrors.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't know if there is actually a link, but it's something that I've found happens, you know, more often than I would attribute to chance. So on the off chance, I got in touch with Julie and said, you know, did your son happen to suffer from night terrors as a child? And he did.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know if there is a link. And if there is a link, I don't know what it might be.
But it's an interesting correlation to make.
Yeah. I wonder perhaps if the night terrors might be that as a young child, you're seeing things out of the ordinary.
Mm.
And obviously you can't, you know, you're too young to really explain what's going on at that point. And your only option
is
to scream and be terrified.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if that's the case, but it is interesting. And I'm interested to know if anyone else that's had paranormal experiences also used to suffer from night terrors. So
thinking back, now that you've said that, and I mentioned, I think my brother used to have them. And the house that we lived in the time was haunted. I'm not sure if that means anything. It's only just occurred to me, but it is interesting. I'll have to ask if he can remember any of that.
Yeah, I know, it's just a gem of an idea, and I just, you know, I'd come across it enough that it piqued my curiosity. So, like I say, if there's anyone out there that has had paranormal experiences, also suffered night terrors, let me know. I want to see if there is more to it than just this gem of an idea that I've got.
For sure.
And then you've got Julie's first story of the man going to heaven.
I know. Well, the thing that struck me about that was the position. She described the man as being in a fetal position, which historically there are a lot of grave burials where people are put into that position in the grave. But the upright sitting position got me, because that sounds like Peruvian mummies that have been found, and they're buried in the fetal position, but they're buried sitting upright head first, just like she described. And again, this is one of these things where I'm not sure what that link means, but that's just what stood out to me.
Yeah, I hadn't sort of attributed that myself. It was, I don't know what it is about the way she described it, but it just chilled me.
Yeah.
It was like the man going to heaven. It touched something in me, not in a sort of, you know, nice way, but
in just a chilling way, from the mouths of babes.
It was just very chilling, which is odd because the way she described it was peaceful. And
I was gonna say that it sounded like a pleasant experience to me, but that's not what you got from it.
I don't know what it is about it. The way she describes it, it was kind of like, you know, oh, it's all very pleasant, and it was, you know, it seemed, you know, interpreted as that was what was meant to happen. And but just, I don't know, just I don't think I've seen anything like that myself, or I don't think I've even heard of it before.
No, this is a new one on me.
Something about that just makes me feel weird.
How strange. Mm. Funny, I didn't have that reaction at all. One of the things I did pick up was Redoubt Fort. Now, am I saying that right? Redoubt, I think so.
Redoubt.
But it's quite famous, whether I'm pronouncing it correctly or not. It's a very famous place to do paranormal investigations. I've heard it mentioned lots of times. So I had a quick look, and there are lots of ghost stories that come out of the fort. There's been shadowy figures seen peering through the windows. Unexplained footsteps and a disembodied woman's voice have been heard. And the apparition of a headless soldier has been seen.
We've got more about headless soldiers coming up in a minute.
We do, in fact.
But I think we need to put that on our coffee field trip list as well.
I think we do. Harwich Redoubt Fort, we must go there. Like Julie, I've got to admit to being a bit sceptical about psychics, especially these sort of entertainment style psychic evenings. But it is interesting that the lady did come up with this name, Violet, and that all panned out very interestingly.
Yeah, like you, I mean, I'm not 100% sold on psychics, but it does seem interesting that unprompted she picked up that the son was seeing something at home.
Yeah, I've got to say, that would be an unexpected thing to just discern from looking at somebody. So maybe there's something in it.
Yeah, I can see, you know, with sort of cold reading and stuff, you'd guess that, you know, everybody's got older relatives, and you could say, oh, you know, your grandma's. But to immediately say, your son sees somebody at the top of the stairs, or I can't remember exactly what the story was, but like that, just like, immediately this.
That is very out of the ordinary. It's not a common thing to come out with.
You wouldn't expect that to be in a cold reader's list of things to go through, would you? No.
Check. Sees ghosts? Check. Well, thank you so much, Julie, for that story. And if you have a story to share with us, please do get in touch. Your stories are the heart and soul of this show.
It's time now for our paranormal postcard. The area in which we live has seen a lot of historic battles. We've already encountered ghosts from the Battle of Naseby and the Battle of Northampton. And as August approaches, with it the anniversary of another battle, it would have been remiss of us not to visit the site of the Battle of Bosworth to see what phantoms we could discover. The Battle of Bosworth Field, or more simply the Battle of Bosworth, marked the end of the Plantagenet dynasty with the death of Richard III, and was a defining moment in British history. Not the largest battle in the Wars of the Roses, nor even quite the last. The Battle of Stoke Field was to follow 2 years later, but, like Bosworth, this battle was also to be a Lancastrian victory. On the 22nd of August 1485, near Market Bosworth in Leicestershire, a 5,000-strong Lancastrian army faced an opposing Yorkist force whose numbers have been put somewhere between 10 to 15,000 in a battle that would see Richard III as the last English monarch to be killed in battle and establish the beginning of the Tudor dynasty. With the king's Yorkist army at least double the size of his opposition's, Richard had initially been confident of victory, but as the battle progressed, his confidence faltered. Seeing Henry, the would-be Lancastrian king, surrounded by only a small guard, Richard made a headlong charge to slaughter his foe. He nearly made it, and the attempt was later recounted as valiant, even by his enemies. But Richard lost his horse in the marsh that separated the two armies, birthing the classic Shakespeare quote, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. And, fighting desperately on foot in the thick of his enemies, he was soon cut down.
When we visited Bosworth, it was the end of a clear, sunny day, and we ambled up the hill to the memorial in the quiet stillness you only seem to find when you're surrounded by nothing but rolling green hills. The memorial is prettily enclosed by hedges and foliage, and itself forms a large sundial, at least 8 feet or so across, and set into the ground. Inscribed into the stone is the story of the battle, and at the centre, a sculpture of a halberd spearing a crown. The wicked-looking blade of the spear cum battle axe shoots up overhead to form the arm of the sundial, and the evening sunlight glinted in the curve of the crown. Standing on the lookout point on such a clear day, we could see for miles, and with only the countryside sounds of birds and the wind rustling the grass, the sun just beginning its lazy summertime descent in the sky, it couldn't have been more peaceful, which made it difficult to imagine the devastation and bloodshed that took place here. An archaeological survey of the Bosworth battlefield site unearthed the largest group of cannonballs ever found on a medieval battlefield, which gives us some idea of the scale of death and destruction. In addition to the king himself, the casualties of this one battle numbered over 1,000. Frankly, it would be surprising if this trauma hadn't left some imprint on the place. Witnesses have reported seeing the ghostly shades of men in armour lurking at the edges of the woods in the vicinity, and a dark hooded figure has been spotted around the battlefield. Locals have long reported seeing curious looking men on horseback riding around as though lost, only to mysteriously disappear. Unexplained sounds are common. The phantom sounds of marching have been heard, and the inexplicable fighting sounds of steel clashing and men screaming. One reenactor heard a disembodied voice barking orders in a foreign language in the middle of the night that he was certain was none of his crew. At first, he didn't connect it to the battle until he later found out that foreign mercenaries were believed to have been hired from Europe to fight in the battle. One phenomenon often reported by visitors is hearing the sound of galloping horses' hooves thundering towards them. Some people have even flung themselves into the hedges to avoid being trampled. But no horse can ever be seen to explain the noise. The nearby village of Market Bosworth has a phantom which has been sighted multiple times, a classic headless horseman ghost. This apparition is heard before it's seen, the clatter of horses' hooves heralding a warning to anyone nearby that they might just not want to look behind them. Those that do dare a glance encounter the figure of a man on horseback wearing military uniform, but rather disturbingly, missing his head. In the 1980s, a lady visiting the area on a coach trip experienced something of a time slip. The sunny scene before her transformed into grey skies and trees. She heard men shouting, screaming and groaning, and the clash of swords on armour. She cried out that she needed a horse and that she had to get to the hill. And so determined was she in her efforts to do so that her friends had to forcibly restrain her and assumed she had taken ill with heatstroke. But to their relief, the episode ended abruptly and all returned to normal. It was only afterwards that she found out that she was a mile or so from the battlefield and that the date was the 22nd of August, the anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth.
Now, there's a few things that may throw a spanner in the works for this explanation. First off, there's, of course, the calendar change, like we had at Naseby.
Mm-hmm.
That there's been a change from the Julian to the Gregorian, or the Gregorian, I can't remember which way it goes now.
But I think it's about 11 days out.
Yeah, it's not long, but it's enough that it wouldn't have been the date of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
The second being that although the visitor centre and memorial is where the battle was believed to be, it's since been discovered that the actual site was a couple of miles away.
Yeah.
So what does this mean for the ghostly encounters around the traditional site? Well, a lot of them seem to be sound-oriented or glimpses of figures in the distance. So it doesn't seem particularly far-fetched for these to be connected to the battle. In the quiet countryside of the 15th century, the sounds of battle would have been the loudest thing that most people at the time would ever have heard. And the sounds would easily have carried across the flat open countryside, and I've got no trouble believing that people would have been able to hear the fighting even if it was a few miles away.
And the same with the horses as well. I mean, horses galloping can be really loud. That sound's going to carry. And also, not necessarily connected to the battle doesn't mean it's not a ghostly experience.
No, I mean, horses have been a mode of transport for thousands of years.
Absolutely. That could be connected to many things.
Coincidentally, there was also a small skirmish at the same site of the 1485 battle in the later English Civil War in July of 1644, where six men were killed.
So that could explain a lot of the encounters. Like with the description of the headless horseman encounters, witnesses say that they noticed a military uniform, but they don't say which era of history.
And to be fair, though British military uniforms changed a fair amount over a few hundred years, they're still, up until quite recently, as in sort of Napoleonic, it was almost always red.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, red and white.
Yeah, I mean, if you presented me with a military uniform from the 1400s and a military uniform from 1645, I doubt I would be able to tell you, well, which was which or even the difference.
No, and it's not like you had mass manufacturing either.
No, there would be some variances. So there could be lots of reasons for these stories that aren't necessarily connected to the battle. Although, in the cases of spotting these figures in the distance, I mean, it could just as easily be connected to the battle. You know, the soldiers don't appear on the battlefield one day. They've got to get there. Mm-hmm. There are lots of incidences that would have led up to the battle and have occurred after the battle.
We also heard something strange while we were there, and this was at the visitor centre, so not the site of the battle.
Yeah, not the actual site, the traditional site that isn't the real site, if that makes sense. It was very strange because it was basically empty when we went. We went after the visitor centre had closed, so everybody else had really gone home. And we just heard this whooshing noise.
It sounded to me a little like not the main charge of a musket or cannon, but what you would put in the sort of the priming pan of a musket or to the initial sort of fuse for a cannon.
You know a lot more about historical guns than I do, but to me it sounded like
yeah, it was sort of that of a sort of fuse or, like I say, the pan for a musket.
It was just really weird.
And but it didn't have the sort of the report of a round. It was just that initial...
Just the whooshing.
Flash in the pan, as it were.
Flash in the pan. But I just couldn't see anything that would have made that noise. We're back to another sort of Twinwood scenario here, really. This field is in more fields. Mm-hmm. It's on a hill, which does mean sound carries. So there's that to consider. Could it have been coming from, you know, a really long way away, and we just couldn't see what was making it. We've got to bear that in mind. But certainly in the immediate vicinity, well, I think we were the only ones there. Yeah. The visitor centre was shut.
There was only one way in or out.
Yep. And there was just nothing for miles. The only thing there is the memorial and the sundial once the visitor centre shut. So there was just nothing obvious that could have made it. Was it paranormal? Don't know.
You know, we could have just heard something that we just couldn't attribute, you know. A lot of times with these things, you're never going to get any sort of definite answer. But it was strange, and it potentially could have been in keeping with what would have happened.
But now we're back to our problem. This isn't the real battle site. This is the not real battle site. So from what I can make out, the actual site is just farmland. So why are we not getting any reports of ghostly activity from there? Well, if it's the middle of farmland, how many people would have a reason to be there? You know, at the visitor centre, you've got hundreds of people coming through there. That vastly increases your opportunity of somebody seeing or hearing something. Whereas the actual site is not open to visitors, it's privately owned, and it's just a field, I think, near a farmhouse.
If it's not got a right of way across it, then no, you know, the only people that are going to be there are people that live or work on the farm or have permission to do so, which won't be many.
No, exactly. Although I would be interested to hear if anybody who owned the farm had ever had any experiences. I did, though, come across one account from somebody who'd heard the phantom sounds of sighting for themselves, and they weren't alone either. A whole group of them heard it. They were scared because there was no explanation and it was the middle of the night, but they didn't immediately connect it to the Bosworth battle, because they were nowhere near the battlefield, or so they thought. They were in the middle of the woods, but later on, one of them saw the newspaper headlines about the discovery of the real battle site, and they found out that it was right next to the woods they were staying in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, turns out we do have some accounts from nearer the real battle site as well. But you see, people perhaps just aren't reporting it because they're not making the connections. They didn't know that's where the site was.
Well, they're either not making the connection or they don't want to admit they were trespassing.
Well, yeah. There is also that. The time slip story, however, is a bit more sticky. So from what I can tell, the village where she had the encounter is not far from the traditional battlefield site, but the actual battlefield site is quite a few miles away on the other side. And the visitor centre is sort of stuck between the two locations. So the village where she entered this odd state doesn't seem to bear an awfully obvious connection to Bosworth. But I will say this, you all know that it's not really my style to go around debunking things, and I've got a very good reason for that. It's not that I'm averse to ruling out practical explanations for things, but I'm very reluctant to simply write anything off because of personal experience. Some of the things that I've experienced, I wouldn't believe myself if somebody else told them to me. Some of them sound unlikely at best and outrageous at worst. But at the end of the day, all I know is that they did happen to me, but I can't prove it. And anybody hearing my story would only have my word on the matter and nothing else. And that makes me very conscious of how easy it is to flippantly write off other people's experiences or to try and explain them away, which I think is insulting to the person who had the experience. I just don't believe that the majority of people would make stuff up for the sake of it. I just don't. Which leaves me with the conclusion that they did have the experience. Whether it was supernatural or not, it happened to them. So I am reluctant to pass this off, especially because this battle took place over 500 years ago. There is so much about it we don't know. We've got very few actual eyewitness accounts of it. So for all we know, one of the soldiers who survived the battle could have retreated as far as this village and then later died of injuries. And it was his impression that she was picking up on. I can think of almost as many explanations for this time slip as to why it could make sense as to why it would not make sense.
Yeah, and in doing my research on this, I actually found that this was one of the worst recorded battles in British history.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there is so little information about this compared to almost any other battle on British soil.
So we know basically nothing about it, really. Anything could have happened.
Yeah, and you know, this is hundreds of years ago. Who's to say that it wasn't a drunk soldier that was like, if I don't get to the hill in time, they're going to flog me for being late for the battle? Yeah, it could be anything.
Yeah, you're right. It could have been somebody that just never made it, and that's where the sense of urgency came from. So many possible explanations.
Yeah, I like you. I'd perhaps go a little further and say I don't mind offering alternative suggestions. But I wouldn't ever turn around to somebody and say, you're definitely wrong, it was definitely this.
Yeah.
Unless I knew for a fact that that was the case.
So we've got this situation where we've got ghostly encounters and reports of apparitions happening away from the site of the original battle. And this, interestingly, leads us to another Bosworth haunting that's even further removed.
As far removed as Shrewsbury, in fact. The largest town in the county of Shropshire near the border of Wales, and a good 60-odd miles from Bosworth. Amongst the many historic timbered buildings that you can still see in Shrewsbury today is the Henry Tudor House, an inn so called because Henry, head of the Lancastrian army, was reputed to have stayed here on his way to Bosworth, and to have stationed his soldiers in the hall behind the main house. As such, the alley that the hostelry is located on is rather aptly named Barracks Passage, and for years there have been reports of phantom soldiers in the area, unexplained sightings of men mysteriously milling about, and ghostly faces pressed against windows. Local legend attributes this to Henry's soldiers lost at the Battle of Bosworth. Some say on account of it being the last place they were happy before their lives were cut short. Some say it was because the town gave them such a warm welcome on their way through. So, if the phantoms of Bosworth can haunt a location over 60 miles away, you can see how, perhaps, the location of the battlefield might not be so important after all.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed hearing all about our visit to the Bosworth battlefield.
We're very nearly at the end of the episode, but just before we go, we've got one more story for you, and this one is from Alyssa.
This happened in 2002 to 2003. I was about 15 or 16 years old. I grew up in a Catholic home. We were religious, but not overly so. We frequented Sunday masses and occasionally helped out at the church. My mother, having grown up in the time of the release of the Exorcist movie, forbade us to watch until my older brother and I were teenagers. When she thought we were old enough, we finally got the okay to watch the movie. All four of us, myself, my parents, and older brother, were all sitting on the couch in the family living room watching. Behind us was the family computer and office area. As we were watching, about midway through the movie, we heard a noise behind us. We all turned to look and noticed that the computer had turned on. The computer turned fully on, the CD slot in the tower ejected and then retracted back in, and then the computer shut off. We all watched in silence as this happened, and then confirmed with one another that no such thing had ever happened before, nor had anyone set some sort of timer on the computer. The computer never turned or shut off on its own before or after that either. My family and I have no explanations as to how or why that occurred. But no one has watched The Exorcist since that time, or has plans to anytime soon.
I must admit, I don't think I know of The Exorcist, and I think I've seen all the major scenes, but I don't think I've ever sat down, start to finish, and watched it.
Well, I'm not sure I have either. We might have to actually do that at some point. Maybe not now.
I'm going to unplug the computer if we do.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for sharing that, Alyssa. That was a great one.
And I'm afraid that that's all we have time for this episode. We do hope that you've enjoyed it. We'd like to say a big thank you again to our wonderful patrons for supporting the show and keeping us going, and also to Red, Ian, Julie, and Alyssa for sharing their stories.
If you have a story to share, please do get in touch at knockoncevs.com. Don't forget, we've also got a Facebook page and group. Please do come along and say hello. We're often on and about to chat, and we also post some of our pictures from our visits there and on our Instagram. We're also on Twitter, and you can find some of the latest highlights of our social media posts on the homepage of our website, so do pop along and check it out. We hope you'll join us next time on Knock Once VS.